Morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Patrick Slevin, and I represent Performance Coal Company in this matter, and we have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, Performance brings this appeal to challenge an attempt by the Federal Mine Safety and Health Review Commission to essentially rewrite a statute that provides mine operators unambiguously relief when the government has exercised its extraordinary authority to shut down mine operations, and to shut down mine operations in a manner that prevents an operator from continuing with its business, and not only continuing with its business, but in this case, from performing an accident investigation. Performance sought relief under the temporary relief statute, which provides unambiguously that a mine operator can get temporary relief from any modification or termination of any order.
Do you actually have to establish that much, or that it is possible to grant such relief?
That it's possible to grant such
relief. At this stage, you're not asking us to say you get the relief, only that the government erred in saying it could not grant it.
All we're saying is that there's a possibility that you can get that relief.
What's the standard?
The standard is that there's a substantial likelihood.
So it's like a preliminary injunction.
It's like a preliminary injunction, and we believe that it's extraordinary relief, but it acts as a counterweight for the extraordinary power that the government has.
Is the argument that you've made in your brief about your ability to seek temporary relief and the decision blocking you, is that argument equally applicable to the union in all respects?
It is, and that is the fundamental point we believe that the majority missed here, is that to the extent that they have subtracted from an operator's ability to gain that relief, they have likewise eliminated that for miners as well. And what the government focuses on is the way that statute is construed, that relief is available for a modified or terminated order, but not for the issuance of an order. And if you look at that statute from the perspective of a miner, which the Mine Act says is the first priority of the Mine Act is the health and safety of a miner. It makes perfect sense that you would permit the government to issue the order, but not but allow temporary relief from a modification or termination of that order. And so from that perspective, the majority has lost sight of one of the potential parties that could claim temporary relief. Their judgment was informed by public policy. And the irony of this decision is that to the extent that it tries to advance policies on behalf of miners, those policies are defeated. The majority said that they were particularly unwilling to interpret this statute after an accident such as Upper Big Branch. That's a policy judgment. That language is nowhere in the statute. To the extent that they say that it would be ill-advised to provide operators relief in such situations. I think the problem with the analysis of the majority is that they saw this as a zero-sum equation. To the extent that they subtract this authority from operators, that redounds to the benefit of miners, and that's wrong. As it stands,
well, I never said that.
Pardon me?
They didn't say that.
They did not say that. But as the majority, or as the dissent pointed out in a footnote, is that keep in mind that you are now preventing miners from claiming this relief as well. And that is one of the fundamental flaws, I think, that the majority didn't see.
How many times was this order modified?
This order was modified by the time of the investigation, underground investigation, approximately 66 times.
Of those, how many, if you can, would you suggest were significant modifications?
Orders are modified to permit rescue and recovery initially, and as time goes on and rescue and recovery is finished, then orders are modified to permit underground investigation. And so early on, within the first week or so, the order was modified numerous times. In fact, that first day, I think it was modified seven times, but it was to permit rescue teams to go underground. And that's another important distinction, to the extent that Congress is focused not on the issuance, but on the modifications. An issuance, an order is issued so that the government can simply establish control of the mine. And so in this case, Congress has recognized that in those instances, it's important for the government to be able to establish control. But to the extent that the government exercises its authority, that is done through modification. And so when they send a rescue team underground, which, by the way, is not a government official, rescue teams are employees of the operator. That has to be done through modification. And so that was done fairly frequently, and those are significant modifications. And that is the reason that there's a distinction between issuance and modification.
Why might an operator seek temporary relief from that kind of an order?
Because it could be that the government is requiring it to do something that the operator may think is not justified on the grounds of safety. Under Section 103K, that's the touchstone, is this in the interest of safety?
And considering the pace of events and multiple modifications during each of several days, how would you even seek temporary relief?
As a practical matter, you would, and that's the government in this case focuses on the catastrophic nature of this accident. But as a practical matter, you probably wouldn't seek temporary relief in a fast-moving environment unless the operator felt that what it was being required to do, what the government was requiring its rescue teams to do, was so dangerous that they would have to request temporary relief. And it's because that it's an emergency situation that that type of relief needs to be available, because otherwise you would be subject to delays in the commission process. And one of the things I point out is...
the order would not be subject to delays. Your client would be...
Would get review.
Yeah.
One of the things that the government focuses on here is they're mixing and matching the analysis of the temporary relief statute with the analysis of 103K. And this is not a case about Section 103K or under Section 107 imminent danger orders, because the temporary relief statute accounts for that. You have to substantially show that you can prove your case that the government has exceeded their authority. But what the government focuses on is that by taking their authority under 103K, they say, well, we should never have our authority scrutinized in a situation like this. But the Mine Act already contemplates that. The government concedes that their authority under 103K ultimately will be reviewed by the commission. They also concede that an operator could get expedited review. So as a practical matter, the Mine Act already contemplates that a mine operator could get their authority under 103K reviewed immediately. So all we're really talking about is burden of proof and whether an operator should have to forfeit its right to discovery, forfeit the opportunity to develop its case. The temporary relief is a unique remedy, much like injunctive relief, and it's not a mix and match. It's not enough to say that because you can get expedited review, you ought not to have temporary relief.
But all we're really litigating in this, if I understand it correctly, is the alleged error of law in the determination that the application could not be granted as a matter of law.
That's exactly right.
We're not even determining whether it should have been granted, but only whether it could have been, whether there's an error of law in the process.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. We believe there was no safety justification for the protocols. That's the reason why we brought the case.
But you don't have to prove that. You don't have to convince us of that in order to win your point on the matter of law.
Because the commission has said, as a matter of law, an operator and, by extension, a mine representative can never, ever get temporary relief from these types of orders.
Right.
And so we are asking the court to set that aside for a mandate.
Give you a hearing. You're not asking that we order them to grant the relief, only that you get a hearing on the relief.
Only that we get a hearing.
All right, thank you.
A hearing only in the loosest sense, not necessarily an oral presentation.
No, I did not intend to suggest it would be a trial-type hearing, but only that you be heard.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And we believe we'd be able to establish that case. But the deeper concern here is that operators now, when there is an imminent danger order that is put in place, where there is a safety order put in place, now may not get immediate relief other than an expedited review.
You said the standard is different?
On expedited review, it would simply be a preponderance of the evidence. It would be like an ordinary case, but expedited without the ability to conduct discovery, without the ability to develop a case. So all of these arguments that the government makes about we have so much broad authority under 103K is really beside the point. It's what does this statute say? The statute says, by its very terms, operators may seek temporary relief from any modification or termination of any order. We believe Congress meant what it said, any order. What the commission here did essentially is substitute a reference to Section 814 that's located in an entirely separate clause that's disjoined by the use of the word or, and essentially eliminated statutory language, the reference to any order. We believe that can't be justified. Instead of applying the terms of the statute, again, they substituted policy preferences. Apart from that, they have rendered one entire portion of the Mine Act superfluous. As we explained in our brief, under Section 107E, there is a prohibition against temporary relief. There's no reason to prohibit temporary relief unless it resides somewhere. The government has made the argument that somehow it can be inferred, but it can't be inferred. Agency authority can only be granted by Congress. They haven't done that in 107. Where have they done that? In 105, the statute at issue. There's no reason for that to be to prohibit what otherwise doesn't exist. The other point, too, is that 107 simply highlights what's missing in the statute 103K. There's no prohibition there. So you would think that if Congress intended to prohibit temporary relief from 103K orders, they would have done exactly what they did in 107.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Ed Waldman, representing the Secretary and Mine Safety and Health Administration. This case is moot. Performance brought this case in order to challenge an accident investigation protocol that was adopted in June of 2010. That protocol was lifted on December 22, 2010, and has been superseded by subsequent modifications of the 103K order. The accident investigation protocol of which they complain is no longer in effect.
They're still under a closure order?
They're under a 103K order, that's correct. But they're not challenging the 103K order. They're challenging the modification of the 103K order, which adopted the accident investigation protocol, which contains certain restrictions of that they objected to.
Which of the modifications do they challenge?
They challenged the 66th modification.
Of 66th?
Number 66.
And how many have been issued now?
Totally 149.
Any reason to think there won't be more?
No, it's likely that there will be more.
Mm-hmm. Our case law suggests that if it would take less, if the phenomenon being challenged would be dissipated in less than 24 months, then it is escaping review, and it sounds like it's likely to recur.
Well, it depends on what exactly is capable of what the event is that's capable of recurring here.
The issuance of a modification for which they might want to seek a delay.
I think the event that's capable of repetition for purposes of the mootness analysis is whether a request for temporary relief is made, because
that's within their control.
Yeah.
That's true.
Okay, so they'll, if we have to ask anyone whether they'll make it, they'll say yes.
Yes, but you can look at the fact that 149 modifications have been issued.
Well, after 66, there was no point making more requests. You'd already said you didn't have authority.
Okay, even accepting that point, still, one out of 66, and as performance argues, they are likely in the
future. It only takes one to prevent mootness, doesn't it, counsel?
There has to be a reasonable likelihood that it's going to recur.
Right.
I cannot recall an argument about from the government that something was not within this exception to mootness that was as strained as your argument on this point.
Okay, I accept that.
It's just almost, it seems like a virtual certainty that there will be repetition and certainly capable of repetition.
Okay. Well, on the merits then.
I'd move there if I were you.
On the merits, the statute, as read by performance, is unambiguous because they ignore the very words that give rise to the ambiguity.
I must say, I had a hard time finding the ambiguity. What is the ambiguity in this statute?
The ambiguity in the statute is whether the phrase under Section 104 applies only to the last antecedent.
I think you're having a hard time, but giving a hard time by taking only the phrase. If you look at the whole statute, correct me if I'm wrong, it says an applicant may file with the commission a written request that the commission grant temporary relief from any modification or termination of any order, or from any order issued under Section 814 of this title. That doesn't sound ambiguous. It sounds as if they can seek temporary relief from modification or termination of any order or from any order issued under 814. So it sounds like this is a modification, and it's a modification of an order, and they're seeking relief from it. And I have a very hard time finding out why the Commission would think it doesn't have the authority to entertain that application.
Well, I will admit that if you look at the statute just
as a whole, like we're supposed
to. No, just that section. I mean, you're only talking about Section 105B2, right? We're not talking about the statute.
That's the only one that governs this question. That's the only section that governs this question. Right, 815B2.
Yes.
Right?
Correct.
I know you like to call it 105, but it's very confusing to us when counsel come in and cite the code in the brief and then talk to us in the act. But 815, right?
Right.
815B2.
Right.
And that's the one that governs the question here, right?
Yes.
And I don't see why it doesn't unambiguously allow exactly what the applicants are asking for.
Well, okay, then if that's the case, then any order would also cover an order that this court issued. Is it unambiguous that the commission then has authority to...
No, they don't have that authority. They don't need this statute. That statute is not dealing with orders of the court. The statute is dealing with orders of the commission. There ain't any question about that. Don't be silly.
If he wants to file with the commission a written request for a temporary relief from this court's order, I suppose we can't stop it from filing that, but it defies any common sense that anyone would do that.
And it also defies common sense to say that this statute
means what it says?
No. To say that this statute is unambiguous, because if you look at it just on its face, that sentence, I mean, I can see where somebody would say, okay, that any order is any order. But if you look even just in Section 105.
Modification of any order.
Correct. If you look even just in Section 105, there's no other reference to any order without some description following it. It either will say...
It would seem to indicate that those other statutes may not apply to any order, but that this one does, since it doesn't have that modifying language.
No. What I was trying to say was that every place else in Section 105, where it refers to a citation or an order, it will say either under the Act or under this section or under this subsection. This reference to any order here is unique in that it doesn't explain any order under what. This would be the only instance where it says, where it doesn't say under what.
I don't see why that cuts in your favor. That seems to me to suggest that this is intended to have a greater breadth than those sections that do have modifiers.
I think it cuts in our favor because it suggests that that phrase issued under Section 104 was obviously meant also to apply to any order, to any modification or termination.
It says from any order issued under Section 814.
Correct.
Right. 814.
Yes.
From any order. Now, in the prior part of the statute, it says from any modification or termination of any order.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't make any sense to suggest that 814 is applying, the language about 814 is applying back before the disjunctive connector to modify the other nouns, modification or termination, when the language of the statute refers to order issued under 814. I don't follow any grammatical or syntactic sense at all on that.
Is it your reading of the statute that it is as if there were two commas that are, they're not there, but certainly cases where commas have been read in and read out, so that the phrase or from any order would be set off by commas?
Yes.
Right. So then we would have temporary relief from any modification or termination of any order, or from any order.
Comma,
issued under 814. So everything's under 814.
Yes, exactly.
If that's the case, then I think what Judge Santel is suggesting is, why would they have the modification or termination clause first? Is that where you were going? Before the order clause. You ordinarily would think there no order or modification or termination of an order, or any order or modification or termination of an order. It would be very peculiar to say any modification or termination of an order, and by the way, the order itself. Peculiar. Not that the Congress can't do peculiar things, but we oughtn't to encourage it.
I mean, I can tell you that if you look at Section 105 as a whole, it becomes, I mean, I could say, you know, this morning I shot an elephant in my pajamas, and you know, it's most people would say, you know, it's not the elephant that was wearing the pajamas, it was the shooter. But then the punchline comes, and it's, well, how he got in them, I'll never know. When you see the second sentence, it becomes clear. You know, the first sentence becomes clear. You've got to look at all of Section...
There is only one sentence in your brief explaining the construction.
Pardon me?
There's only one sentence quoted in the briefs explaining the construction. I picked up the blue one rather than the red one, but... Where is your language in your brief that sets out what you're now saying?
The second sentence.
It gives us more of the statute that you think should come up with the opposite, should lead us to come up with the opposite conclusion. What part of your brief are you referring to now?
The background section lays out the...
Find for me the quotation of the whole statute in your brief that you used to construe this way, or with that extra sentence.
We're doing this because you were trying to rely on the following sentence, the one that says the commission may grant such relief?
No.
Oh, I thought that's where you were going.
You don't know where he's going either, in other words. Where are you going?
I'm trying to make the point that...
This doesn't sound like the argument I read in your brief, exec. I don't remember you even quoting the other sentence in your brief, but...
I'm not talking about the other sentence.
We're not?
That was left over from the elephant example with the second sentence, the punchline.
Right. Okay. I guess.
So the argument has nothing to do with what we're talking about now. That gets us back to where we're having to construe the sentence that's quoted in the petitioner's brief. That is to say, the one I read to you earlier, or read most of it to you earlier. And that just doesn't seem to mean anything other than what the petitioner says it does.
Okay. If, you know, the petitioner repeats quite a few times that in determining whether a statute is ambiguous, you've got to look at the statutory context and the statutory structure. And I think that's true here as well, just like with respect to the elephant. If you look at Section 105 as a whole, I think it might become clearer.
That gets me back to what I was trying to ask you. Show me the statute as a whole, how it comes up with something different than what we've had so far. And Judge Ginsburg suggested one thing you might be arguing, but you said no, and I don't know what you're talking about yet.
Okay, well, I'm trying to get there. Okay, Section 105.
Which is the same as 815, right?
Yes. Would you prefer I use the 800s?
You know, I would prefer you did, yes.
Okay.
You know, as I said a while ago, it gets very hard to follow counsel when they cite one system of citation in their brief and then get up and use a different system of citation orally. So, yes, I would prefer you did.
Okay. Section 815 is as a whole, is concerning itself with actions taken under Section 814. Under 814, the MSHA will issue citations for violations. And for certain more serious violations, it will issue orders which require that minors be withdrawn from the affected area until the underlying violation is abated. When you go to Section 815, okay, 815 talks about the commission's jurisdiction to adjudicate contested violations. And if you look at how Section 815 is broken down, Section A talks about the monetary consequences of a violation, of a citation. Section B talks about the non-monetary consequences of a violation. Okay? Now, Section A, talking about the monetary, talks about, you know, the MSHA has to assess a fine and or penalty, and this is what an operator has to do to contest it. Okay, so you get to the non-monetary part. That's 815B, okay? B1 talks about citations, and B2 talks about orders. Okay, B1, when it talks about citations, it's talking about if the operator doesn't abate, you know, it's subject to an additional penalty. But B2, which is where we're at, talks about the non-monetary aspects of an order. And it says, in recognition of the I've got a red light. May I continue?
Go ahead, please.
In recognition of the severity of an order requiring the withdrawal of minors from the affected part of the mine, we will give an operator temporary relief from such an order if they can make, you know, their meet the criteria of, you know, reasonable likelihood and so forth. And in that case, they will not be required to shut down their mine or a part of their mine while they're abating the underlying violation which gave rise to the issuance of the order. Okay, that order was issued under Section 104. 814, sorry. And then the rest of Section 815 is subsection C is a whistleblower provision, and it's there because that's, you know, 105 is where the commission has jurisdiction to adjudicate these disputes in general. And then subsection D sets forth the procedures for adjudication of contested violations. So if you look at 815 as a whole, you see fairly clearly that they are talking about actions that MSHA took under 814.
Now, before the statute was amended in the 79 version, where there were two, the clauses were enumerated, would you say it was to the same effect then? That it was also part of a, viewed in context, had to do only with the enforcement scheme for orders issuing under the previous section? 814.
There's in the previous version, there's not a last antecedent problem because of the two numbers and the commas.
I understand that, but yeah. My question is whether the scope and application of the statute of these provision, I mean, in that version, in that act, was the same as the one you're suggesting
yes.
scope here.
Yes.
So that section still, at that point, dealt entirely with the enforcement, adjudication, consequences, and so
that's
on
correct.
Of an order. Okay.
Okay. We have more than used your time now, counsel, so thank you, and we'll, how much time do you have left?
2 minutes.
Oh, you got 2 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
Your Honors, Judge Ginsburg put his finger right on the common sense problem here, is that if Congress genuinely wanted to limit temporary relief to orders under Section 814, it could have very easily worded the statute that way. And if you notice in Section 817E1, the Congress set forth issuance, modification, termination in that order. And they could have done the same thing here. They could have provided temporary relief from the issuance, modification, or termination of an order under Section 814, but they did not do that. And
what about the sequencing of those terms?
The sequencing, you can find that sequencing in Section 817E1, I believe. And that indicates that where Congress intended to include issuance, modification, and termination, it did so.
So if the orders subject to petitions for modification or termination are not limited, as Mr. Waldman suggested, to orders issued under 814 or 104, are they limited at all?
I'm sorry.
What kind of, putting aside orders of the court and orders from 814, are there any other orders that under your construction of the statute would now be susceptible to a petition for temporary relief?
The modification.
Or modification. Orders. Oh, yeah, modification, I'm sorry.
Orders that are issued in the event of an accident, and those would occur under Section 813J and 813K. J doesn't refer to orders, it refers to actions of the government, but as that's been applied, the government issues orders under J. It would also apply to a category of orders under 817 for imminent dangers. And what's interesting...
Well, that's kind of anomalous, isn't it? Imminent danger orders could be the subject of a petition
for temporary
relief.
That's why there's a prohibition on a particular type of imminent danger order.
That's in E1.
On E1, that's right. E1 refers to a prohibition on imminent danger orders that are issued under 817A, but issued. It doesn't use the term modified or terminated. So, and as the dissent pointed out, that what is subject to temporary relief is not an imminent danger order when it's issued, but when it's modified or terminated, as with the temporary relief statute, it is subject to temporary relief. One other portion of the imminent danger statute that was ignored by the commission and not within the government's theory of the statute is you can issue an imminent danger order, or it's kind of a quasi-imminent danger order under Section 817B. In instances where the government has determined that while there is not an imminent danger, they don't have a reasonable assurance that an imminent danger won't arise. And so under our construction and the plain language of the statute, those are subject to temporary relief. Under the government's construction of the statute, they don't account for 817B. They simply say, like the commission, well, imminent danger orders under 817A, Congress couldn't have intended that loophole. Again, that's the language of policy. That's not the language of the statute.
We have exhausted your time as well now. And
thank you very much.
Case is submitted. Give us recess. Thank you.
Thank you.